Welcome to Common Sense Care, parenting your gender-confused child with truth and love. So-called affirmative care is the gender industry's one-size-fits-all treatment plan for any and all children who suffer with their identity. In no other area of medicine, education, or psychology is one treatment plan assigned to every person. At Partners for Ethical Care, we believe that each child is an individual and should be given the treatment and the support that's most appropriate for him or her. So good morning, I'm Maria Kessler.
And I'm Erin Brewer. And what's our topic for today?
The topic today is dealing with the world and the extended family.
Now that sounds kind of strange. Can you just explain what that means for people who may not understand?
Yeah, well, they say it takes a village to raise a child, right? And we're all connected to our near family, our extended family, our neighbors, the school community. You know, if you have a faith community, you're connected in all these ways. And that village can be really supportive and helpful in raising your child unless they're not. And when it comes to gender identity, unfortunately, the bulk of society has been conditioned, and I would even go so far as to say brainwashed, to believe that affirmative care, which is telling the child, yes, you really are the wrong gender, or you really, your body and your mind are mismatched, but that's the only thing to do. And so if a family who's dealing with a transgender identified child says, you know what, I don't agree with that. I've known this child, you know, for 12, 13, 14, 15 years. They have never indicated a discomfort with their sex before. I think something else is going on. When a family does that, you will quite often find that the larger society around them, the rest of their tribe, is actively working against them to support the child. And it really undermines the parents' efforts. And it comes out of this strange sense of wanting to be the valiant savior of the child. I hear that over and over and over again. And especially in school settings, teachers and counselors are being taught this. You may be that child's only safe space. Mm-hmm. If their parents don't affirm them, you may be their only safe space. And that's kind of a heady, like, ooh, I get to be Superman, Wonder Woman who saves this child from their toxic family. And that's so dishonoring to families, and it undercuts all of your efforts to save your child.
It's really discouraging because I do believe that the vast majority of these people are really, you know, good-hearted people. They're doing this because they honestly believe that this is some, you know, the best for the child. Yeah. And as you said, I honestly believe that society has sort of been brainwashed, that they're accepting something because they're being told that if they don't accept it, that they're unkind, mm-hmm. intolerant, hateful people. And so they're going along with it without giving it a whole lot of thought. And like you said, oftentimes they feel like they're that one person that might intervene to save this child, which is, again, this is playing into people wanting to be kind and caring for a child without understanding the implications. And it might sound really absurd to think, well, how can everybody else be wrong and the parents be right? How is it that we've gotten to a point where society has accepted this? Maybe everybody's accepting it because it really is the right way to proceed with these kids. And I think it's really important for us to sort of address that there have been times historically where people have accepted great horrors unquestioningly. And that this is something that happens within society occasionally from time to time. There is an acceptance of behaviors that is incredibly damaging and harmful and can be embraced by people who are good and kind-hearted.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we've seen that with horrors like the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And I think in that time frame, there were a lot of people who knew that this was wrong. What was happening in Nazi Germany was wrong, but they were afraid to speak up. They were afraid to go against what the dominant culture was doing because they themselves would end up on a train to Dachau. Yeah. So I see that happening a lot with this issue as well. I hear from so many people, and I suspect you do as well, who say, thank you so much for what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, this is awful. This is horrific what's happening to kids. I'm not able to speak publicly. I'm not able to write publicly because I fear for my job, because I fear, you know, for my reputation, because I fear, I have one parent, more than one parent actually, who's told me, I'm afraid my kids will be retaliated against at school. Mm-hmm. And I had this experience. My son, who's a senior in high school this year, one of his friends on Instagram posted to him, why is your mom such a hateful bigot? Wow. And that's a hurtful thing to experience. And a lot of people are afraid of that. But I think that's sort of evidence that there's a problem here.
Yeah, I think that's really a good indicator that something's off. My son had a similar experience where he was at a bus stop and somebody came up and said, I hope you know that there are a lot of people who want to kill your mom. Mm-hmm. What a horrible thing to say to a child. Mm-hmm. And yet this movement has emboldened people to say things like that, which again, it's an indicator that they're using fear and intimidation and bullying in order to forward their agenda. And those are all indications that something's not quite right. Mm-hmm. When people have to be bullied like that, when people are afraid of losing their jobs, when people are afraid of being harassed and potentially even harmed for speaking out, that's an indication that this is not about being kind and tolerant. This is about an agenda that's being pushed. And there have been times in history where we have committed horrible atrocities, where we have sterilized people against their will, where we have given people lobotomies. And like you said, the Holocaust, we have had instances where we've done experiments on people, such as the Tuskegee syphilis trial, where we've used human beings as experiments. We've even had slaves. So human beings are capable of treating others really inappropriately and horrendously. And I think that's what's happening here. And as you said, people are afraid to stand up. And it's kind of within our natures. We have studies that show that people, the majority of people, are willing to conform to what's around them rather than standing up because they are afraid of retaliation.
Well, and it's also a good part of human nature that we are socialized by those around us. You know, when children are growing up, they're being socialized into how to behave as a healthy functioning adult, what things are appropriate to do and are not appropriate to do in society. And that's actually a healthy thing, except when it becomes not healthy. Yeah. When bullying is what's being used to apply pressure to somebody, or when someone who is just a little bit different than other people are told, well, you're wrong because you're different. And I think that a lot of times what's happening with this transgender movement, a lot of these kids are kids who are kind of on the fringe. Mm-hmm. They're vulnerable. They don't quite fit in. I'm thinking about the vast numbers of them that already have prior issues like autism and trauma and depression, and those are the kids who are being targeted by this. And I think you have to look at that and say, okay, something's wrong with that. If the vast majority of this group already have struggles, and yet we're not allowed to address those struggles, that's a problem. Why can't I say, hey, 65% of kids who identify as transgender are on the autism spectrum,
which is a huge number. I mean,
yeah. And what happens when you say that? Yeah. You get called a bigot, a hater, a transphobe, the whole nine yards. Again, that's a red flag that something's wrong. But today, I think one of the main points we want to talk about here today is how to deal with that when you're a family and you have decided that you don't buy into the gender industry's dogma, and you want to take a different path with your child that you think is going to hopefully save them from being medicalized. How do you deal with all of these people around you who are not only not for you, but who are actively against you.
Right. When your authority is being undermined, when your child is being told that their misperceptions are correct, it is really a challenge. And ideally, I think I would recommend cutting those ties. I think that those influences are so powerful, and we actually we know that you know these kids are vulnerable, as you said, and so if we can shield them from the influences, that's going to be really helpful. It can be really hard if every single other adult that child knows besides you is affirming them, because it does seem like, you know, wait a minute, all these other adults are telling me I'm right and only my parents aren't. And then you add on top of that, them saying, well, your parents are hateful and bigots. And so I think that there's sort of a two-pronged approach that needs to happen to figure out who in your extended kind of community is affirming your child in these negative thoughts and cut those ties, but also develop ties with people who aren't doing this, because it's so important. As you mentioned, we are social creatures. We need connections, and especially children, it's really important for them to have connections. And so sort of as you're cutting off ties with people who are not safe for your children to be around, exploring ways to get them around children and adults who are going to be safe for them.
Yeah, what you said about socialization, I just think we can't emphasize that enough, that we become what other people tell us we are. Mm-hmm. We really do. And I've quoted Goethe before, who said, treat a man as he is and he will stay as he is. Treat him as he ought to be and he will become what he ought to be. Mm-hmm. And what people reflect back to us is how we view ourselves. So I think that's one of the very insidious aspects of this gender ideology dogma, is if a child is already struggling with their identity, which is a normal part of adolescence, mm-hmm. figuring out who you are, that is part of your job as an adolescent. And so when these vulnerable kids are targeted and they're going through this identity phase and somebody comes and tells them, oh, you feel that way because you're transgender, mm-hmm. mom and dad are saying, no, I think you feel that way because you're autistic and you're adolescent and this is normal. That's the only voice telling them that. And their teacher is telling them, no, you're transgender. And their pediatrician is telling them, no, you're transgender. And their therapist is telling them, no, you're transgender. And the family that they babysit for is saying, yeah, that's so great that you came out as transgender. Aren't you brave and stunning? And the neighbors are it's just
overwhelming. Yeah, it is overwhelming. And as you said, children can live up to expectations or down to expectations. Mm-hmm. And this is, as you said, a vulnerable population, because in addition to autism, many of these kids have been sexually assaulted or had other trauma in their life. Some of them are just confused about gender stereotypes. You know, you have a feminine boy and all of a sudden he feels like he was born in the wrong body because he's embarrassed about, you know, having these feminine traits. A girl who would have been called a tomboy for eons is now being called, you know, born in the wrong body. And so it is such a powerful message. And again, I think part of the strategy for parents needs to be to identify who it is in their community who is encouraging the child to believe these things, because these are really dangerous things to believe. First of all, we've talked about the medicalization that happens. You know, you put this kid on the pathway to puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and surgery. All of those things are harming a healthy body. It also undermines the parent-child relationship, which is probably the most important relationship a child has. With, you know, once that gets compromised, that child loses a really important support system. And it also undermines their ability to trust and are very vulnerable. So identifying who is it in the community who's really affirming this. And some people might be affirming it in a way that is really dangerous, and other people might just be kind of going with the flow. And so I think probably you mentioned in an earlier video to find out who it is who your child is safe to be around and who they aren't safe to be around, is just to ask the person a question like, wow, I just heard so-and-so's child came out as transgender. What do you think of that? And just see what their response is. And if they say, oh my goodness, isn't it wonderful? That child is so brave and stunning. That's someone that you need to not have in your child's life. Whereas if they sort of say, wow, yeah, I'm really sad to hear that. I'm confused. And my, you know, aren't bubbling over with enthusiasm, then maybe that's someone who is going to be safe for your child to be around. And just to explore, you know, teachers, neighbors, community members. I use this analogy a lot, the drug user, but it's sort of like, think of your child as having a drug addiction, and who's going to give them that child drugs and who isn't. And that's pretty much what this is, because that affirmation actually produces drugs within the, you know, chemicals within the child that act as drugs, those endorphins that make them feel so good about themselves. It's much like getting a drug. And so would you allow your child who has a drug problem go visit people who you know are going to hand them drugs? Probably not. And that's really what this is like.
But once you've done that, once you've kind of parsed out, okay, these are the people I can trust, these are the people I can't trust, it can be really difficult to keep the child away from the people who are not going to be your allies in this. And thinking about, you know, the doctor, when you take the child to the doctor, especially as kids get into their teenage years, it's very common for the doctor to ask the child, you know, would you like to speak with me alone? That's a normal thing. Mm-hmm. Doctors really are looking for signs of child abuse. And that's one sort of gatekeeper, that if the parents are being abusive, you know, the doctor can find that out from the child. So that's not necessarily a red flag if the pediatrician, you know, asks you to leave for part of the exam. But in this case, if you're not sure what your pediatrician's office, what their policy is on this, I would really not be comfortable with leaving the room, because I've heard of pediatricians asking very loaded leading questions, you know, do you feel safe at home? Do you feel supported at home? Are your parents, you know, supportive of this, and sort of leading the child? I would even go so far as to maybe change doctors if you don't feel that you can really trust your doctor's office. But I also want to say, doctors cannot just come out and say, no, I don't agree with transgender ideology. The laws are being changed so that doctors and therapists cannot disagree with this. They have to affirm it. So you have to be a little bit 007-ish in some of your questioning. But if you want to interview, you know, ask to sit down with a doctor in person. Don't even do it over the phone. Sit down with a potential doctor in person and just say, you know what, I have a child who identifies as transgender, and I don't really think that's what the issue is. What are your thoughts on that? Mm-hmm. And see what the doctor says. If you hear a lot of the propaganda, well, I think it's important to let the child lead. Children know who they are. We need to be affirming and supportive. You hear that propaganda, the slogans coming out, you know that's not a doctor you can trust.
And it's really important to know that, because I've heard doctors say in front of children and their parents that if a parent doesn't affirm the child, that that child's going to kill themselves, which is a horrible thing for a child to hear, because it sort of is tacit approval for suicide. It indicates to a child that suicide is an appropriate response to not being affirmed, which is just an incredibly devastating thing to say to a child. The other thing that is of concern more and more is that doctor might report you to Child Protective Services if you're not affirming them and if they believe you should be. And that has pretty serious consequences that a child may not really understand. Sometimes children are just mad at their parents, and they might say, yeah, I just want them to call me my chosen name and pronouns, and they won't do it. I just hate it. They're so mean to me. And that might be enough for a doctor to feel like they can call Child Protective Services. Once that happens, it can be just a nightmare. And I've talked to parents who've had this happen. And I actually know of a case right now where somebody called Protective Services on parents who weren't affirming their child. And the parents are on administrative leave while they're being investigated, all because somebody felt like they should be affirming their child and they're not. So you have to be really careful. The stakes are super high here. And you risk even losing custody of your child, depending on where you live and what the circumstances are. So finding those people who are going to be supportive of your approach to this is going to be really important.
Yeah. And I also want to encourage parents again, focus on your relationship with your child. Try to foster a good, healthy relationship with your child and make the focus off of the transgender issue as much as you can. If your family likes to go skiing, go skiing. If your child likes to, you know, go fishing, go fishing. Have those experiences and those times and really seek to know your child. I think it can be very tempting in this case to make every conversation about the trans thing because I want to get this over with. I want to move you through this. Let's logic you through this. But really resist that urge and get to know the child. Ask the child about, hey, you had a test today. How did it go? Because ultimately, unfortunately, Child Protective Services or the pediatrician may ask the child, are your parents supportive? Or, you know, do you feel in danger with your parents? The stronger your relationship is with your child, the less likely the child is going to say, yeah, I hate my parents and I want to leave. Mm-hmm. It's really sad to me that we're to the place where we've got to, you know, they may ask the child and the child's going to make the decision in this case, but that's where we are. Yeah. That is where we are.
And Maria, we have a video that's going to sort of talk about how easy it is for the community to embrace this transgender ideology, because I think that very few people understand how insidious this is unless they're actually in it. And again, I think what happens is that there are some very powerful forces at play here that are just bombarding society with these messages. These forces are very powerful, and they have a lot of money, and they have a lot of invested in propagating this attitude. So you know, when you wonder, like, how is this happening? How is it that everybody's bought into it? This video might explain it a little bit.
Groupthink is a term coined by social psychologist Irving Janis to describe what happens when a group makes bad decisions because they're too caught up in the unique internal logic of their group. When a group gets wrapped up in itself and everyone agrees with each other, no one stops to think about other perspectives. As a result, you get some big and bad ideas, including some enormous historical fiascos like the Watergate cover-up and the Bay of Pigs invasion and the Chernobyl nuclear reactor accident. So while two heads may often be better than one, it's important to make sure those heads are still open to different opinions, or they can do some really dumb stuff. In the end, it's best to understand ourselves and our decisions as informed simultaneously by both individual and group factors, personality, and situation.
That's a fascinating video. I mean, just the way social psychology can apply pressure to people and make them do things that you would think no rational human being would do this. But when everybody around you is doing it, it's amazing how susceptible we are to social pressure.
Yeah, and in this video, it's not in this clip, but earlier in the video, it talks about Stanley Milgram's experiment, mm-hmm. where he basically was able to get most people to give painful, what they thought were painful shocks to somebody in another room, electric shocks. And it was to the point where, you know, it sounded like the person in the other room was like in serious pain and maybe even hurt. And the person, the scientist said, was like, okay, go ahead, give him another shock. And a lot of the people did. A lot of people didn't. And so that's the good news, is that there are people who will stand up and say, no, I'm not going to do this. This is not okay. But there are a fair number of people who, you know, if they're told that they should do something, even if it doesn't feel quite right, they're going to go ahead and do it because they don't want to buck authority. They don't want to go against social trends. There's another experiment called the Stanford Prison Experiment, where they recruited students, and some of the students were prisoners and some of them were guards. And within just days, the guards got brutal. I mean, they ended up having to end the experiment early because it got so out of control, and the prisoners became so dehumanized so quickly, and the guards became so brutal. And so it is easy for people to be influenced. And I think that's what's happening now. And this can be really difficult when we're dealing with community members that are close to your child, or potentially even relatives. There are cases where grandparents are 100% wanting to affirm the child, or nephews or nieces or aunts or uncles. It's possible if you have an older child that they work somewhere where they're being affirmed. And so there are all these different situations that as a parent, you kind of have to say, wow, is this a safe situation? And how do you deal with that, Maria?
I don't really have an answer for how to deal with all these situations. Some of them are so difficult, especially if your child is older. Mm-hmm. You know, the younger your child is, the more control you have. I know of one family that the daughter babysat for a family in the neighborhood and had babysat for a couple of years. And then the daughter came out and said she was transgender. And the family for whom she babysat was supporting her behind her parents' back. The parent found out that the family had given their daughter one of these new trans novels. Translit is the new young lit bit. I never thought I would miss the vampire and werewolf craze of the Twilight series. You know, we had vampires and werewolves littering the shelves for like 10, 15 years.
I thought it could get worse.
Oh, now it's translit. Oh, can we go back to the werewolves and vampires?
I am seeing so much. There's this whole series that's sort of like trying to replace Harry Potter, where it's, you know, it's boys can be witches too. Mm-hmm. Girls can be warlocks. It's everywhere. And so, as a parent, depending on the child's age, you have more or less authority, but it can be really hard when you think you're sending your child into a safe environment and then you find out that the people are undermining you. I have heard of cases where parents have just moved because they feel like they're in an environment where they're not going to win, that they can't escape that. They can't cut the child off from everybody. And so they move somewhere where they feel like it's going to be safer. I've heard of situations where parents have taken kids and gone on, packed up the van and gone on a year-long trip around the country just to separate them. And again, not everybody can do that. Most people can't do that. Yeah. And so really, I think probably my recommendation would be to identify people who are the worst offenders, and really make a concerted effort to separate your child from them, especially if you're in a community where the vast majority of people feel like, you know, this is a great thing and that your child's brave and wonderful. Maybe just finding the people who are the worst offenders, and then just really trying, like you said, to build that relationship with your child. The stronger your relationship with your child, the less susceptible they are going to be to these really negative influences.
Yeah, well, and in situations like with the babysitting family, I know that family just decided my daughter's not going to babysit for that family. They didn't say that overtly, but every time the family called, hey, can she babysit? Oh, I'm sorry, she's busy tonight. COVID has actually been a really good benefit for that family.
Well, and I think that's a really good way of doing it. So rather than telling the child you can't see them because they're affirming you, just do it kind of subtly, because we know teenagers like to push back against things. So if they know you're doing this as, you know, specifically because that person's affirming, they're going to be like, yeah, you're hateful. I've been told about, find people who love me for who I am. Whereas if you just sort of subtly do it, that's going to be a lot more effective.
Yeah. And you might even have to be a little surreptitious. If you know, grandma and grandpa who are going to, undermine you, want to have your child over for the weekend, rather than just blanket saying no to that, maybe you buy some concert tickets or something that child really, a group that child really wants to see that weekend, and go, oh my gosh, grandma and grandpa invited you over, but we've got these concert tickets. What do you want to do? let the child be like, I'll see grandma and grandpa some other time. I want to go to the concert. Well, we have a statement from a listener. Usually listeners send in questions, but we got a really good recommendation from a listener for how she dealt with this issue. She said, I did have one friend who I used to invite over when my daughter was coming to act as a buffer. She was amazingly good at small talk and was brilliant at filling in the gaps in conversations. Because she wasn't me, my daughter would excuse her if she asked the wrong thing. It made the whole visit so much more pleasant and acted like a brilliant buffer zone. So it sounds like the daughter was a little older, maybe not at home anymore. But when they got together, the mom would have this friend come because she was just a little bit more, a little removed from the situation. The daughter liked her. The daughter was more tolerant of her mistakes.
Well, and a lot of times, you know, kids will not cut their parents a lot of slack, but they will cut other people some slack. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that this is an approach that you could even take, perhaps if you have people who are affirming your child and it's someone that your child needs to interact with, maybe find someone who can act as a buffer in that situation.
And also, if there's somebody who already is in your circle who has a good relationship with your child, I'm thinking about aunts and uncles are often so much more cool than mom and dad are. Mm-hmm. And if there's a brother or a sister in the family, aunt or uncle, or somebody who the child has always thought, oh, that, you know, Aunt Susie's really cool. If you can get Aunt Susie on your side, she can be a fantastic help because your child is more likely to open up to her, to respect her without some of the baggage that comes with the parent-child relationship.
I think that that's really true, especially in this situation where you have, you know, a girl perhaps who's really hating herself for being a girl. If there's a beloved aunt who can come over and maybe, you know, that child is going to be able to hear from an aunt, you know, it's really hard being an adolescent. This is a tough time. Most of us hated our bodies when we were your age. The child may be able to hear that from the aunt in a way that she won't be able to hear it from you. Yeah. So I do feel like that's a really good strategy. We have a question and it says, how do I identify all the influences in my son's life? I don't even know most of his friends. And that is a big issue, especially for older kids. I think it's a little bit easier with younger kids, but once kids get older, who knows who they're hanging out with? And you don't want to be, you know, that extreme helicopter mom who, you know, follows their kid to school and spies on them. So what recommendations would you have for this mom?
I think one place you can start is just sit down and make a map. Like I do this sometimes when I'm struggling with, I did this one time when I was just overworked and I sat down and I got a piece of paper and I wrote, okay, I have my kids. I have my job. I have my volunteering. Mm-hmm. I have my hobbies. And then from each one of those circles, I was like, okay, my hobbies are knitting, crocheting, you know, and I just made this map and I found where all of my time was going. And then I could identify, you know what, this thing, I don't really enjoy it. It's not feeding into my life. Let me get rid of it. You can do the same thing with your child's relationships. Okay, we've got school, we've got his part-time job, we've got social media, and you know, we've got his therapist. And just on that paper, map out everything that you know of or that you can think of. Like, okay, he's on social media. I know he's on Snapchat. I know he's on Reddit. Get your kid off Reddit. I know, you know, write down, get them off all of it. It's all bad. Your child has a job. If you're able to visit mm-hmm. and get to know some other people, you may be able to identify somebody who, you know, you could kind of partner with. Like, could you let me know, if, you know, you see anything troubling? That's a place to start.
Yeah. And I would also try to make your home open so that your child feels comfortable having friends over. Oh, yeah. Because you learn a lot once your child has friends over. And I have to admit, there were times that that my kids, when they were younger, had friends that I didn't particularly like, but I felt good having them over to my house because first of all, I could build a relationship with them. And I also kind of knew what they were like and whether or not that was a kid that I felt was a good kid for my son to go say, spend the night with, or if it was maybe, you know, if you want to spend time with that kid, you got to do it at our house. Yeah. And that's okay to do, to say, you know, I'm a little bit uncomfortable about this particular friend. I don't want to say you can't be friends with them, but if you're going to hang out, you need to do it at our house. I think that's really valid. The other thing with younger kids that's just good to be aware of is that people have different ideas of when children are able to spend time by themselves. Mm-hmm. I know that when my kids were little, I was shocked to find out that there was a parent of one of my child's friends who felt that their five-year-old was perfectly fine spending the afternoon by themselves and would be okay having my son over. I wasn't okay with that. Yeah. I don't think five-year-olds are old enough to be on their own for you know, hours on end. Yeah. And so again, as a parent, I think that it's important to sort of identify what are you comfortable and what are you not comfortable with. And it's perfectly okay to say, you know, have Joe come over here. You know, you don't want to tell your kid, I don't like Joe, but just say, you know, I'm just much more comfortable when Joe's over here. I think that he really likes coming over, and, you know, have him come over. We'll make some cookies, you know, do something fun with the child. So there are lots of options. Again, it's really hard if they end up in the LGBTQ club at school or something. Suddenly, all of their peers are going to be part of this agenda, and then it becomes really difficult. And you might just have to be firm and say, you know, these are not children you're allowed to spend time with.
Keep in mind, your end goal is to have a healthy, safe child who makes it to adulthood intact.
Right.
And most parents, I think, are willing to sacrifice an awful lot to protect their kids. Well, this has been a good conversation. Thanks so much.
Yeah. What's next week?
Next week, we are going to talk about gender dysphoria and autism.
Okay. Which is so important, as the research is coming out and showing more and more of the kids who are being kind of brought into this ideology are on the autism spectrum.
Yeah. And there's more and more evidence that they're being preyed upon. Yeah. So we need to talk about that and how to deal with it if you have a child on the autism spectrum. We are not doctors or therapists. We are not giving medical or psychiatric advice, and we offer no guarantee of outcomes. We simply want to talk about how to support and love kids using long understood best practices from the fields of psychology, education, and child development. We're glad you joined in our conversation today, and we hope that you took away something you can put in your toolkit for parenting your gender-confused kids with truth and love.